Guys, we're going to cut the opera short because Felix Burrichter is here, and he wants to talk to you all. He's got a Nina Hagen song that he'd like to start off with. So here you go, and enjoy Felix talking to Dongping Wang and John Wang.
Wind bläst, meine Nase friert und der Auspuff Rohre knattert nach. Da geht die Sonne unter, rot mit Gold, so muss das sein. Sie schob die Straße runter, fällt mir mein Bekannter ein. Prompt fällt mir's jetzt schwer ums Herz. Ich brauch nur Vögel, und fliegt mein Blick dann himmelwärts, tut auch die Seele weh, wie schön Natur am Abend, stille Stadt, verknackste Seele, Tränen rennen, das alles macht einen mächtig matt und ich tu einfach weiter fennen auf.
Thanks, Felix.
You're welcome.
So that was Felix's walk-in song. Why'd you choose that song?
Because you've been playing opera all morning, and I really like Nina Hagen, and I thought it was the perfect combination.
It was a pretty amazing transition. So we're here
with Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Felix Burrichter is here, and John Wang is here, but John is going to read Pinup for a little bit, so he's just relaxing with some tea. So I'm going to bug Felix for the first half hour. So thank you both for joining us on this Halloween day. So for those who don't know, Felix founded and runs a magazine called Pinup. I feel like easily, arguably, I think the best architecture magazine, at least in my opinion. Honestly, the only one when we go to a magazine shop or a bookshelf that is appealing in any way. So, hey, thank you for the magazine. And just excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, one thing we've been trying to do is just not really focus on what you do now. I think it's exciting, particularly to kind of see how you got here. But in order to do that, I think it's good to understand sort of what you do now. Literally, for example, like today and in the last week, what you've been up to, what your day-to-day in terms of running a magazine like Pinup entails.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you do today?
Today, I had a meeting at 8:15.
exciting world of magazine.
It was an exciting meeting because it was about a potential short film we might be doing for short film. I mean, this may be a little much, but a little video production we will be doing for 2019. We're already talking about spring summer 2019.
Are you allowed to talk about what that short film is
actually
about?
I wish I could, but it's okay. I'm not allowed, actually. It involves lots of textiles.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Rooms and textiles.
Have you guys done any film or video stuff before?
We have, actually, yeah. We it's actually something that we were doing more and more with Pinup. We just finished a small film. And when I say film, I mean, you know, no longer than 2 minutes. Mm. About the Italian, the late Italian architect Luigi Cacciadominioni.
Okay.
And he was, I met him actually when he was already 102 years old.
That's nuts.
In 2014.
Where did you meet him?
In Milan. Yeah, I don't think he really.
He didn't fly. Throw him on a plane.
He even ever left his office. I think he was just kind of glued to his. Maybe that's the secret too.
Just don't move.
Just don't move.
Save all that energy.
And he is kind of not very well known, but he started his own. I mean, he built mostly in Milan, but he also designed a lot of furniture because for the spaces that he created. And it's not very well known, but it was recently reissued, all the furniture. The company's called Azucena.
Okay.
And we made so we took a lot of the pieces, which are really kind of special pieces because they're kind of like, I mean, timeless is kind of an overused adjective, but they are timeless in the sense that you look at them and you actually don't know what year they're from. Yeah. You don't know whether they're from 1850 or from 1950 or from 1990 or
that's
from
crazy.
2018. There's kind of an uncanny timelessness to them. And we filmed them with a drone in some of the spaces that he designed in Milan. So a theater, a shopping gallery, what else? And a private home.
Okay.
So, and in this kind of, so we kind of push this uncanniness even further by using a drone. Huh. And so it's kind of a very abstract film. We're doing a lot more of those.
So, I mean, maybe that's a good, like a video like that mm-hmm. is obviously not what you'd expect a typical magazine to do. Because it's a video, for one.
Right.
Which is very exciting. So how, with that project specifically, how did that project come about? How did you end up shooting a video with him and about the furniture that he's re-releasing?
This kind of development is exciting for us because it's a very natural evolution of what we were already doing. And Pinup started 12 years ago.
Okay.
And it was, you know, as a kind of print, well, not as a kind of, as a print mm-hmm. magazine. And staple bound, like very, not DIY, it was always professionally made, mm-hmm. but it, you know, it was very much kind of like it still had a very zine-y feel. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it really evolved into something very, you know, I mean, it kept its spirit, but it was, you know, it kind of became more sophisticated and also made use more of other media, you know, I mean, and with the website, so digital, and which allowed us to now explore all these opportunities for mm-hmm. film. And so for me, the film is just kind of like another way of showing what we're already doing in print, but kind of make it accessible through a different medium.
Do you, before we get into, I guess I don't want to get too far yet, but do you...
Sure, any of that, it really made sense.
No, it was there was actually, there was all these like avenues I wanted to jump in on that, and I'm trying to resist because we will. But just really quickly, right now, what's the circulation of Pinup?
The circulation is 35,000.
Okay.
I think close to 35,000.
Do you know how many countries you're in?
Yeah, I can probably even list them off the top of my head. I mean, the main is the U.S. Mm. It's a U.S. publication, so it's over 50%. I think the second market is, believe it or not, Germany. Surprise. And closely followed by France.
Okay.
And South Korea.
Right. Yeah, makes sense.
And Italy, of course, Spain, UK, you know, Holland, mm-hmm. Belgium, you know, a lot of Western European countries. And then Japan, although Japan not as much as we used to. Mm. I think, I don't know why. If Japan, if you're listening.
It's not too late.
Get back in on the game.
Are most of the... because I'm also just very curious on the business side. Like, are most of the sales in-person retail from a magazine shop or a bookstore?
Yeah, I think we have about 20-25% subscription.
Okay.
Which I'm always surprised, but I think it's actually because it only comes out every 6 months. So maybe people enjoy the discovery of actually going to buy, either making that direct purchase or you know, discovering it in a store.
It is very exciting to see a new one. But wow. Maybe because of that 6 month thing where it's
right.
You kind of get used to the cover on the shelf for a little bit. Right. And you're like, oh shit, a new one.
So but I don't know why people don't subscribe more. I don't know the psychology of that.
Hmm. And in terms of, let's say, creating that video content, obviously creating the content that goes in the print magazine and online, do you treat the content, I don't know how to ask this question, but do you sort of segment how you think about creating content based on whether it's going to go online versus print versus video, or is it sort of all things that you want to do as Pinup, and obviously then the venue presents itself depending on how best to present it? Does that make sense?
We're still figuring that out too. Everything that we do is always a very organic process, and you know, especially in the beginning, kind of the website was just a vehicle to tell you that there was a print issue, and then it was almost like the stepchild of the publication. In, I would say, within the past two or three years, we've really invested a lot of time and effort in making the web as exciting as the print issue. Or I don't even know if I want to see those two as competing, because they really, I mean, just like you see in the, you know, with these films that we're doing, it's, you know, they're very complementary, because we would have never been able to do that before in any other way. No one would have been able to see them except maybe at some, you know, obscure screening somewhere. I think that is that the web really allowed us to do things that we aren't able to do in print. Mm. And so rather than seeing them as competing, I think they kind of really work together. And so I don't make a distinction between, like, a hierarchical distinction whether something is only going online, right. You know, as something that is valued less because it's only online, or something only goes in print because, you know, they serve different purposes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially also when it's something, you have a timely, you have an exhibition, you have an interview with a curator, You want that interview to be up while the exhibition is up.
Do you try to have a, like with the video, do you try to have a representation of it in the print as well in some format?
We do, actually. I brought it.
New issue.
This is radio, so I can only describe what you're about to see. But we have a, we have the, well, I guess not. Actually, it's not in here. Where did it go? Maybe John took it to the bathroom.
Can I put a photo up of the new issue?
No, actually, don't. Okay, well. It's going to drop on Monday. All right. We can only describe
it'll ruin the surprise of the bookstore.
We actually had to stop because someone was doing, we had students from Parsons at, in our office yesterday, and one of them was doing a live stream to her school in Shanghai, I think it was, and we had to stop like, her no, from don't. we had to hide the issue, and then we had to, when we pulled out the issue, we had to ask her to stop filming. It was actually she probably thought we were crazy. But the where was I? Oh, so the website. No, I don't make a, there's no hierarchy. Yeah. But sometimes we also, you know, like right now, there's an interview. It actually went live today. Two things went live today that are going to be in the issue, that you'll be able to see in the issue. One is a story with Telfar mannequins.
Okay.
That was shot by Thomas Alpdorf. Huh. And
meaning specifically about the mannequins that Telfar uses?
Well, yes, a little bit of both. Yeah, it's a design story with Telfar mannequins.
Got
so
it.
It's like a family. It's a family story. It's a family album with
amazing
design pieces. And then the other story is a Martha Rosler interview because she's opening her show at the Jewish Museum on Friday.
Okay.
Her irrespective retrospective. Mm-hmm. It's a big survey show that she does. And the issue is the home issue. And, you know, she deals a lot with the things around, you know, the issues around the home, the notion of home and homelessness and, you know, kind of patriarchal structures tied to the domestic realm. And so that went up online. So, you know, you can go to www.pinupmagazine.org. And read it.
It's amazing.
And then you can also read it in the magazine.
Which issue number is this?
This is issue 25.
Cool. And you said it was 12 years ago that issue 1 came out.
Yes. 2000. Actually, on the day. On today.
Today?
Today, 12 years ago.
Is your 12th year anniversary?
Issue pinup number 1 came out.
Wow,
yes,
congratulations.
Today, yeah. It was Halloween. We had our launch party on Halloween.
That's awesome. In New York.
In New York. Where was it? It was behind St. Patrick's. What is that? The Urban Center. It was called the Urban Center.
Oh, yeah. Is that still there?
Yeah. And we had, actually, it was, we should do that again. We had topless construction workers behind the bar.
You should do that every year.
We should, well.
Maybe it gets old.
We also had, like, what was that? We had also had, the next one was, no, anyway, I'm not going to go into that. But
let's go through all 12 parties. I bet they're all good. How has it, I mean, not the production necessarily, but the focus or the topics that you don't cover or really want to cover, how has that changed? Like, do you remember the content in the first issue versus 25?
Yeah, I mean, I remember.
Is it remarkably
yesterday.
Different? Or
no, it's actually, it's, I mean, it's surprisingly consistent in the subject matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the subtitle for Pinup is architectural entertainment, and that was a very that seemed like a very radical concept in 2006. I don't know how radical that still is in 2018. Actually, I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot here, but I feel like architecture, just like art and fashion, have been really kind of commodified in a commercial way, in this big, you know, constant cultural production machine.
I mean, I will say, and I don't know if this is, it seems like it's in line with that. The reason the magazine is really appealing to me is because I feel like it's still the only architecture magazine, and even architecture is a much broader term, I think, in Pinup than it is in other publications. But that in that entertainment side, that it seems to appeal to people beyond architects. And there's
that was always the goal.
And that's weirdly, there's not a lot of architecture magazines that I feel like do that. With the exception of, let's say, an Architectural Digest, but that's a totally different type of way of appealing to a broader audience. And every other architecture magazine that I see seems like it's very much within and for your classic architectural discourse.
Well, I think there's architecture as an industry, you know, the building industry, and as a kind of trade, a trade industry. And there's a lot of people
that work in it.
That work in it, yep. And so there's publications for that. But there's also architecture as a culture. Mm-hmm. And I think the industry, there's people who work in it, and it's a very specific type of very specific jobs related to architecture. I think architecture as a culture is much broader, and I think it affects all of us. Mm-hmm. Every single person. I don't know a single person who's not affected by architecture. It's impossible unless you live on an island by yourself with no built
anything whatsoever. Anything,
exactly. So well, then you're affected by the lack of architecture, I guess.
There you go.
So I think Pinup is much more interested in the latter rather mm-hmm. than the former. And I think that's kind of has been kind of the guiding principle for... Mm. And that's why we're able to bring in a lot of different themes, you know, whether it's art and fashion design, you know, all these, and kind of bring it all under the umbrella of architectural culture mm-hmm. in the way. And I think that has been really consistent since the first issue.
What did you, with that first issue, because I can imagine a lot of people may want to start a magazine, whether architecture or not, but want to start some sort of publication. Do you remember the mechanics of getting that first issue off the ground? Like, was it all, where did that first dollar come from? Was it from the first issue? Was it before that? Was it
issue five? Well, I was working as an architect
okay.
at the time.
Where?
At KPF, Com Patterson Fox.
I know your KPF.
Yeah, you were there?
No, but I feel like half my friends at some point did some version of a stint through KPF.
I was actually, my fellow KPF-y, we sometimes forget that's how we know each other, is Jing Lu.
Oh, yeah.
We worked together. She was a lot more appreciated. Her work was a lot more appreciated at KPF than mine was. I think I was like... After a while, they figured I'm best for photoshopping. but no offense to KPF, but I was very miserable there, and I kind of used it this idea of a publication as a kind of outlet for kind of as a creative outlet, really, or intellectual and creative outlet. And I had interned for publications before, so I kind of knew
which ones.
It was, well, several, actually. It was when I was studying. I studied in Paris. So while I was undergrad, and I was working for Numero. Mm-hmm. It was like a fashion magazine. But I was the intern, but I was also in charge of like all the architecture and design research, because they always had a design mm-hmm. section. And then afterwards, I interned for Butt magazine mm-hmm. in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. Butt and Fantastic Man.
Oh, wow. It's a pretty good lineage.
And that's actually, I mean, Numero was great, but I think the most formative experience was working for Butt and Fantastic Man, because at the time, they're much bigger now, but at the time it was me as an intern and the two founders. So basically two magazines.
And these stints at those magazines were before your KPF run?
No, that was actually, okay, I did that internship while I was on hiatus.
From KPF?
From KPF, because I had an H-1B visa, and there was a gap of, I think, 4 or 5 months. And so I used that gap to do an internship at these magazines.
Okay. So obviously you had an interest, obviously, in magazines, but did you always know you wanted to start your own?
I didn't even think it would be possible until I worked for Butt, because... You know, it seemed like, you need a publisher and you need to have a staff of at least 30 people, you know, and a design department of 10. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed completely out of reach. And then working for Jop en Geert in Amsterdam for a couple months, I realized that,
that's
Butt. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah. You know, that was two guys, doing it all by themselves and doing it better than most other people. So that was really inspiring. And that actually, that's what made me want to start Pinup. And I actually had, my ideas for it were pretty well formulated already because I think it was also because of that internship. You know, I kind of was like, okay, I want to do interviews and I want to do photo stories and I want to do like an essay, you know, because it was like a kind of combination of the stuff that I had really liked in grad school and I felt like no one else knew about, you know, essays and about architecture you know, it's not something that a lot of people know.
Right. So when you were at,
it's pretty obscure,
at KPF and decided that you wanted to, or one question is, even when you started it, did you think it would become your full-time thing when you first started, or
Absolutely keep you happy? Never. I thought it was like a fun side project. Huh. Yeah. I mean, it was, and it wasn't actually, it probably would have always remained a side project if it hadn't been for the, for Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because that's, at some point, I remember I got a, you know, because all of my salary from KPF was going into printing. Hmm. I would, you know, I would invest I wasn't even making that much money though, but I, but it, yeah, it all, that's what I needed to kind of pay the rent and, you know, also like save money for printing and, you know, like, I mean, I didn't have real advertisers. Huh. But a weird combination of events happened. One, Lehman Brothers. So a lot of projects just dried up. So it took a couple of months for it to affect the building industry. But I think after approximately like 9 months later.
Yeah. But I also think it actually, I remember feeling the effects of it before the kind of general populace knew what was going on. I remember same thing, a big party that I was on. Just started really slowing down. The financing was slowing down before anybody knew what was happening.
Right.
It was like these projects are getting slow for some reason. Nobody had obviously predicted something like the crash, but I feel like banks knew and we're starting to dry up.
Well, maybe
on
we
the
should
loaning.
Ask.
Yeah.
Let's ask some people at KPF or like the big corporate architecture.
Are you
offices.
Still getting the loans you need?
Well, I think, so that really, you know, one day I get called into HR and I say, you know, we have to lay off 250
people.
Had you
started Pinup at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. 250 people. They laid off 250 people.
Jesus Christ.
I know. I mean, between London and New York. Nuts. But it was, yeah. I mean, that made me feel a little better, but.
It's nothing personal. You just don't have a job.
So, and that really made me, but at the same time, you know, this was happening all across the board in all industries. So also in. Also in publishing, I mean, one magazine after another, you know, even like the Martha Stewart type magazine, everything was basically drying up. Hmm. So what caused me to lose my job at this corporate office also actually drew new advertisers to Pinup because it was now that, you know, because the market got a lot smaller.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So
like
people who would have never considered advertising in Pinup now did because there were no other magazines
that's
left.
That's so crazy.
I know. So we kind of benefited from that. In a
did you have way. Advertisers from issue one?
That are still advertising?
No, sorry. Like, were you able to already bring in advertisers for that first issue?
Yes.
That's impressive.
Two, yeah.
Who were they?
It was Vitra and Comme des Garçons.
That's a pretty good start.
And they actually still advertise to this day.
Wow.
So
and
actually, Comme des Garçons, where are you? You need to come back. You haven't been.
You need issue 26. Still got. All right. So I'm trying to think.
Because you know we're also talking about how did you get started? If I were to I think the most important thing when you start a magazine is to start with. An idea, you know, an idea that you feel really, really passionate about. That it's almost because, you know, if you want to make money, don't start a magazine. that's advice number one. Maybe a media company, but don't start a print magazine if you will. A print magazine really is like, it's almost like a, you have to have some kind of like almost pathological obsession about something, like a kind of urge to condense it into this object of a, and only then are you able to kind of endure all the, I mean, I don't want to say hardships, I'm making it sound like really, really dire, but you know, I think, you know, you make a lot of, it's hard, yep. You know, it's very time consuming. It costs a lot of money to print. And so you really have to want to do it. Mm. And in order to also use those resources and, you know, like kind of put all this energy into the project, you have to really feel super strong about it. Mm. So I think you're doing well if you have some kind of obsession that you can't get out of your head and you want to kind of channel it into.
Do you know where that, the idea for Pinup, whether it's about the kind of based on that tagline of architectural entertainment or the kind of an underlying message you wanted to focus on, do you know where you started developing the idea that there needed to be, or you really wanted to make some sort of publication focused on that?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier, how, you know, there's architecture as a business or as an industry, which is what, you know, I was doing at KPF and what, you know, a lot of architects that you know, that I know, that, you know, that work the daily grind of the, you know, and then there's architecture culture and, or architectural culture. And I wanted to talk about the culture part. And I felt like there was no other publication that did that in a way that was also accessible to people outside of the industry. Mm. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And where did you grow up?
In Germany.
Where in Germany?
In Dusseldorf. But no one in my family is an architect or...
Well, I was wondering, because even the distinction...
A publisher, for that matter.
Even the distinction of architectural industry versus architectural culture, like, it's easy to understand, but actually, especially in a place like the U.S. where I think design in general has a different cultural relevance than it does certainly in Europe and other places around the world. And I think to a detriment in the US anyway. But I guess part of it was like, did you have a sense that what architecture's role was, whether not that the architecture's a profession, but just sort of the awareness that built environment was designed and thoughtful for good and bad when you were growing up in Germany? I only ask because I don't think it's that apparent growing up in the U.S. for many people that everything is architecture in some version, that your built environment has been thought of by someone. I don't know if that's a question you can remember or think of, but...
Yeah, I think my interest in architecture came from... I want to say from kind of like a... from the inside out, so kind of like thinking from within the domestic, and then kind of working your way, you know, kind of almost like a from the inside of an onion, layer by layer, kind of, you know, your most intimate space, and then going into the public, civic architect, you know, kind of public space.
Do you remember what that first intimate layer was?
I mean, obviously, I mean, I guess always the home you grow up in, right? No, I don't. Actually, I don't remember. Hmm. No. I only remember always drawing houses, like, you know, designing houses for myself. I could even draw the house that I designed for my favorite one. I had like a few options, but the favorite one.
Were you drawing them as floor plans? Or were you drawing them?
Yeah, as floor plans, as floor plans so and that's, elevations.
That's amazing. How old were you?
I don't know, 4, 5, 6.
That's incredible.
But at the same time, I was also drawing like a fashion collection every year.
Huh.
Yeah.
So you always had like that extra.
So there was always that, yeah. There was always like an extra fashion, like frivolous layer there.
So then, up until from when you were 5, I guess, already drawing floor plans up until the break from KPF and starting Pinup, was it a pretty linear progression through architecture, or did you bounce around?
Well, I think the weirdest thing is that I always wanted to study architecture, but I never thought I would actually work as an architect. And then when I actually did work at KPF, I was like, oh God, this is not at all what I wanted. So in a way
What did you think you would do?
I don't know. I really had no idea. Yeah. I just knew I loved it. I was in for the ride, but not really thinking about the...
So you kind of found a perfect way to be in it, but not
yeah.
work
I mean, and you know, and also in you're not, at least for undergrad, you're not burdened by, I wasn't burdened by loans, you know, by student loans mm-hmm. or anything. I was, you know, I still had to pay my living, and I was fortunate enough that, you know, for that part...
Because you're in Europe.
Yeah. You know, I was fortunate enough that for the undergrad part, you know, at least the living expenses were, I could rely on my family, and then the school was free. Hmm. So, but then in the US, it's very different. Hmm. You know, you have to immediately think how you're going to pay all that money back.
Right.
Whenever I think about it, I don't know how I even, I think, I sometimes think if I grew up in the U.S., I don't know whether I'd even still be doing, or if I'd be doing, I mean, this is not a very motivational
speech. No, but I think it's important.
But it would freak me out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it takes a lot more to follow
passion.
Your calling, your passion, or whatever. Yeah, that here than it does in an environment where, you know, you have more access right. to education without this kind of cloud of
financial burden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So I was thinking this is a good time to invite John in. John, do you want to I'll put on your mic.
Now it's getting interesting now. Finally.
Hi, John.
Hi.
So this is John Wang, an artist and good friend of Felix, and we actually only just met about 20 minutes ago, half an hour ago. But thank you for joining. But
thank you for having me.
One of the reasons was besides, I mean, I think what's really interesting about Pinup in general, and certainly Felix, as you were talking about it, is the ability to connect architecture to things, not just in the industry, the kind of culture around architecture, which extends to so many other disciplines and creative disciplines. And the fact that you're an artist here, I think obviously there's a sort of oftentimes a direct connection from architecture to artists, but I don't think it's rare that I actually get to sit with an artist and an architecture publisher and an architect at the same time. So real dumb question. How did you guys meet?
Yeah, John, how did we meet?
How did you meet?
Well, actually, I think we met at a party once, but I feel like when we actually met was when I first made a meeting with Felix when I first moved to New York, and this was like in 2000.
Where did you move from?
I was living upstate for a while, and before that, I was living in South Africa, but that's another story. But and when I finally moved down to the city, I was supposed to move to the city before that, but I kind of decided to run away with my boyfriend, and we like did this whole other thing. But so eventually I came down to the city, and I, upstate, I was working with this guy named Joseph Holtzman, who did Nest magazine. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing experience working with him, and he's inspired so much of like my work. And so when I came to the city, I kind of immediately found Felix and went to him and asked him if I could work for Pinup, actually. Because to me, it was like this kind of contemporary version of how I thought about Ness. In
Wait,
a lot
John,
of ways.
Can I ask something? Does Joe Holtzman know about Pinup?
Yes. Oh. I think so.
It's exciting.
We should send him issue 25.
Felix just had a very proud look on his face. It's very exciting.
But then, yeah.
I mean, just to, you know, for the record, I'm a huge fan. So it's like if he knows it.
That's awesome. You guys have never met, I guess.
No. No, he's a bit of a recluse, no?
Yeah. Yep. And he's kind of been hiding out for the last decade, kind of painting. And Yeah, I don't know. That magazine was so incredible. And so when I came to the city, I was really excited about kind of continuing that line of thought. And I asked Felix for a job. And Felix said, we don't have any jobs. And then I feel like a couple days later, he called me and he was like, actually, let's make something up for you.
And you ended up working there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was doing like digital editing for them. Right.
How long were you there?
I mean, I'm not officially there anymore, but I feel like
he's always there.
Always there. But I don't know how long it lasted. Maybe a year or two.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very like I was saying earlier, everything's like very kind of fluid and organic. Like people
are always contributing to in one way or another.
Yeah. I don't want to be like call it pinup family, but you know, I think like once you've been kind of there, the
you're like sucked in for life.
Yeah, for better or worse. Exactly.
Were you, when you were applying or walking into Pinup to work there, were you already practicing art for yourself?
Yeah. I was making work, and I had this kind of weird experience of kind of running away upstate and hiding and still making work, but kind of in secret. Mm-hmm. And I got kind of weird about it and wasn't showing it to anyone. And that was kind of part of the reason why I kind of ended up having to like come back into civilization, because I was just becoming, I mean, I'm a Cancer, so like I can easily disappear and get really weird with myself. So, but yeah, I was making work, and coming to the city was a way to like start participating kind of in a conversation again.
Sorry, it just came back to me with the party where we met.
Sorry. Was it a pinup party?
No, oh. No. Never. It was a birthday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for like timeline's sake, when did you move back from upstate?
I think that was in 2015.
Okay.
14, 15.
And how long were you reclusive in upstate?
For like 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Basically, my partner and I, when we ran away, we ended up buying this like old house, like junky house together, and we ended up starting to renovate it by ourselves mostly. And then we kind of got trapped in that, and we ended up doing it for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so immediately when we finished, I was like, I have to leave.
Do you still have that house?
We actually recently just sold it this past summer. Yeah. Actually, we turned that project into this kind of, we called it like an Airbnb residency project, where we hosted artists and they made kind of different work for the space, including like Misha Khan and Ann Libby made like bathroom tiles, and we had people making furniture and we hosted artists, and they kind of like came up with their own kind of design object, furniture objects.
And those are still in the house that someone just bought?
No, we took them with us. Oh. And we're hoping to do another project somewhere else. That's cool. In the near future.
Okay, so then where did you run away from to go upstate?
Well, I was supposed to move to New York for grad school at that time, right before I went up there. And I was just moving back to the country from
South
Cape Town, yeah.
Is that where, and sorry, I'm just want to set it up. So yeah. Cape Town, how long were you in Cape Town?
I was living there for about 2 years.
Okay, and then before that?
I was in school in the Bay Area. I went to Berkeley.
Me too.
Oh, really?
I feel like there's always like a Berkeley for sure, but like a California
cool.
connection with
Don, aren't you from San Diego?
From San Diego.
Oh my God.
Did you study architecture at Berkeley? Oh, cool.
Yeah, I did the like Northern California was the furthest I wanted to get at that point from Southern California.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, this isn't that bad. And then New York seemed like a nice place, after, like an equal kind of feeling of far enough away.
Yeah.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up between L.A. and Thailand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Meaning you were always hopping back and forth?
A little bit, but mostly I was in California as a kid, and then I went to middle school and high school in Thailand. But I was always kind of coming back in the summers. And
is your family Thai?
No, my parents are Chinese. The reason why we moved there was because they became Christian missionaries.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it gets the plot.
Are they still there?
They're not. They're actually back in LA now.
Oh, okay.
For the most part.
But they only did it in Thailand, or did they also move to other countries?
No, they were only in Thailand. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. Why Thailand?
Because God called them there.
They just looked at the map and was like, this is the least. They need us the most.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you feel like, well, one of, I guess, if you're bouncing back and forth, I guess, as a kid, mm-hmm. did you feel a sense of home in either of the places? Was it hard to actually feel settled, or as a kid, it was actually not that hard?
I think that at that point, I had kind of lost traction with any of them mm-hmm. as home places. I mean, it's interesting because I just got back from Thailand yesterday because I was doing an exhibition there, but I hadn't returned back there since high school for like the past 15 years or something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that's partially because I don't really think of it as home necessarily mm-hmm. or any other place. But also just because I think the experience more just made me put me in this constant state of motion where I'm always just kind of moving around to different places. So, yeah, I don't know if I have a home. I don't even think about L.A. like that. Mm.
It from San Diego, anyway, it was New York weirdly feels the most home to me. I mean, now I've been here a while.
Me too. Actually,
Much more than where I grew up, even though my family's there and a lot of my very good friends are there. But
can I ask you where in San Diego?
So I grew up in an area called University City, which is basically between where UCSD is and where a town called Claremont is. So it was like, I loved it, but it was the most no real quality suburban area. Like you could not find it off. Like it was the most generic, nice place. It was like working middle class. I was part of the little league team. There's just like no identity to the area, which was actually sort of interesting at the time. There was like one grocery store, one comic book store that I hung out at. Mm-hmm. And then for high school, my parents moved up to Northern California into much more of a beachy, affluent neighborhood. But I think it was important to grow up in a completely like vanilla place. I've noticed now, for example, I love suburban developments. I mean, I don't love them to want to live there, but I love wanting to do it as a project. There's something really fascinating to me about
it.
Like all of the colors of like beiges and mm-hmm. light pinks of the whole thing. It's like really fascinating to me. And I think it's just from that. Anyway, sorry, I didn't want to sidetrack. But
No. It's all related. My next project is actually about that.
Really?
Too, and it's about LA.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
but we can get into that later.
Yeah.
No, it's going to do now. Actually, can you talk about it?
I'm trying not to talk about it too much because I talk about everything
a
lot.
What a tease.
But I'm actually working on developing a TV show in LA about Monterey Park, which is this kind of Chinese neighborhood that on the surface just looks like any other strip mall LA area. But underneath the surface, it's like all Chinese.
It's super Chinese.
Yeah. Like you don't even have to speak English there ever. And
did you spend much time there when you were growing up?
Yeah, my family's been in and out of there my whole life in that area, like the San Gabriel Valley. And I kind of wrote this kind of TV show years ago and no one understood it, I think. But now I kind of think the world is ready, primed for it.
Is it a fiction show?
Yes.
Is it a drama?
Yes.
Are you starring in it?
I'm not going to be in it.
Okay.
I'll make a cameo for you.
Under your own name?
Yeah.
I mean, we would take trips from San Diego up to Monterey Park just to eat.
Yeah.
And then drive right back down again.
I know. Well, the other interesting thing about that area to me is like it's never been depicted in American media, which is so crazy because it's this whole reality and it's a big part of LA.
But it's not suburban. It's
It is suburban.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like cookie cutter suburban, but it's still.
Is it LA County or Orange County? Or
LA County.
It is LA County.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It was always like part of that weird soup of stuff that wasn't quite LA, mm-hmm. not San Diego, but
totally.
Just an area where all I knew about it was there was a lot of restaurants there, apparently.
Exactly. But it's thought of as the Beverly Hills, the Chinese Beverly Hills of LA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So a lot of people from like Taiwan and China know about it, and it's a place they like want to move to. Yeah.
So you grew up in at least in LA side, a pretty heavily Chinese area.
So yeah.
It's the Chinese version of Baldwin Hills.
Exactly.
It's good. That's a good review. Sorry.
But it's not really fancy, though. But they like to call it Beverly Hills.
Baldwin Hills. Yeah. Really.
Random question. Did you see Crazy Rich Asians?
I actually have not seen it yet, but I was planning on seeing it like today or tomorrow.
I will come with you.
Because we had a date.
We had a date months ago. It didn't happen. And we didn't
have you seen it?
No, I haven't. I was waiting for John to come back from Thailand.
Well, just because you mentioned that, I mean, even specifically the Monterey Park area being not represented, but like it's nothing special really as a rom-com.
Yeah.
But I just remember it's A, crazy. I don't remember ever seeing a widely released movie in the U.S. with almost all Asian actors.
Yeah.
And there is a part, there are a couple parts where the leads, the Asian male leads would be shirtless.
Mm-hmm.
And two girls sitting next to me were like, ooh, they like hooted the screen. And I was like so happy because I was like, you rarely ever see an Asian male as a sex symbol.
Exactly.
And I was like, I love that it's
except
just like
at this table.
Thank you. We're also shirtless for those listening. But it was funny how much of a difference it made, even though it was a very saccharine movie. It's very entertaining. Like, it's worth seeing for sure, but it's not any movie except for the fact that it was so Asian.
Wait, when they're in the U.S., where is it kind of set?
Is it New York? Hey, Bella.
Yeah.
Is it New York?
New York.
They're in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, but most of it's
New York
in Singapore.
And Singapore. No.
New York and Singapore. Yeah. Most of it's in Singapore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or some version of Singapore.
Or some version of Singapore. Well, Bella grew up in Singapore and said it was like there's real worlds like that.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I don't know if you want to keep talking about your TV show, but I'm really excited. Are you trying to make it as realistic as possible?
Yes and no. I mean, my kind of objective with it, which was before, actually I was writing it before Fresh Off the Boat came out. Mm. And I was like, I want the first Asian American TV drama to be like really twisted and weird and nasty, you know, like, because there's so much like kind of white assimilation tied to Asian culture, especially in Hollywood. Like, all these Asian characters are playing white people, mm-hmm. basically. And I wanted to like go in the other direction and make them really bizarre and even more alienating. I don't know if that's good for the community, but it's just a personal goal.
Do you have a name for the show?
Yes, but it's a working title. But at the time when I was writing it, I liked the idea of it being a kind of like Twin Peaks meets Friends thing. And so I wanted to call it Friendly. And instead of Central Park Cafe, there was all kind of revolving around like a late night, like Chinese boba dessert kind of spot.
So like a weird twisted Friends.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Chinese because people. Friends is the most popular show in China.
It is?
Oh, yeah. Really? Yeah.
To this day, or especially. Yeah,
it's
this.
Still.
Okay, yeah.
So would you sucker people in with like very happy, smiley characters and
exactly.
then just slowly melt them away?
Exactly.
Is it going to be like a Monterey? Was it Monterey?
Monterey Park.
Monterey Park Rachel haircut.
Ooh. Ooh. I might start using that.
The Monterey.
You know, at this point, this is the, you know, projects like this and what John does is actually the part of the reason that I make Pinup still after 12 years, because it's, you know, this is, it's not really, he's not an architect, obviously, but so much of what he does as an artist touches on architecture. And I think this is what we were talking about earlier about this idea of architectural culture, where, you know, kind of there aren't that many platforms that treat it. You know, obviously there's a lot of art, there's art press, you know, but there is no one who talks about these things from an architectural point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Or from a design point of view. So I think this is, I see it as my duty.
Exactly. I mean, that's why I love Pinup too. And in my undergrad, I studied art, but I also did I mean, technically it was called social anthropology, but I was mostly doing kind of urban design and urban studies. And so I was in the architecture building a lot.
You were?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
And it's right next to the anthropology slash art building. So I was like in that zone all the time. And
which at the time made no sense why they were in the same building, but now it's such an amazing combination.
Yeah, exactly. But so, I mean, I was always paying attention to architecture, and my work has always kind of been about space, whatever that means.
And across all sorts of different mediums, right?
Yeah. But, and I think that's what's so exciting about Pinup, because it kind of is so expanded in its way of thinking about architecture, and that's so important to me to be able to talk about those things from that kind of vantage point.
Well, I think actually space is a really good, is a key word, because it's also, it's a way of providing space for voices that you, that otherwise aren't heard in or paid attention to in other platforms, you know, because precisely because they don't necessarily fit exactly in one category or.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you remember the first time you were able to either create a piece of art or represent something that wasn't typical or expected from you?
Can you talk about Shui?
Shui.
Because he's starting a spa.
Can you talk about your spa?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah, I mean, okay, well, that's a good thing to talk about. I mean, so I've been working on creating this kind of queer bathhouse spa in Chinatown here. And it's kind of been a long process, and it requires a lot of money, and it's a big project. But for me, like, my kind of personal investment in it is kind of thinking about actually about queer architecture and what that could mean. And by that, I'm kind of talking about how traditionally kind of bathhouse wellness spaces are either like for kind of like straight communities or really gay communities, but there's nothing kind of in between for kind of like trans or non-binary people. And so for me, I was like thinking about a way to how we could design for that. And also just thinking about the right to wellness in general. And so that was a project I kind of began a few years ago, and it was born out of this other project we did upstate and thinking about kind of new ways of working with hospitality. And yeah, it's a project we've been working on. Actually, it was really encouraging last night to listen to your show and hear Josh from the Highline and Plus Pool and you talking about Plus Pool and how long the process can be sometimes, because working on the spa has kind of been this really long extended project where sometimes I feel like it's just my queer utopian world building project and it's just in my head, and people have written about it, including Pinup, and so a lot of people kind of think it exists, but it hasn't.
It exists. I think it does exist. Yeah.
And it exists, and it's
just not as a physical space.
Yeah. You had a party sort of around it
exactly
last year or something like that?
Which actually people thought was the actual spa.
Yeah.
It's like, this spa looks a lot like a bar.
Exactly.
When it was actually just the bar.
Imagine if we designed that place.
This was in that funny hotel that's on
the
bar.
It was in the Wyndham, like yeah. It was in the basement of
that's
the Wyndham Hotel.
That's our aesthetic.
Yeah.
But I think the idea exists, you know. I think that the space exists as an idea, and I think that's sometimes just as important as a physical space.
Totally. And I mean,
if you think about, you know, if you historically, if you think about the Fun Palace, which was never built, or you know, like I think there's a lot of spaces that never materialized.
Totally.
I mean, I'm not saying Shui is never gonna be built, but I think
it's already real in that sense.
But it's already real.
Oh, totally. And I think the amount of conversations that have happened around it, just between me and friends and our community, has kind of been really amazing. And thinking about it, I mean, even now, like with this whole Trump thing and all of these things happening, like
what Trump thing?
Like, I'm just kidding.
We don't mention his name on the show.
Do we have another?
We'll just bleep it out.
Yeah.
This is where the sound effects would come in.
Exactly.
Oh, where's the sound?
We should have had the sound
effects. Yeah, Felix, look for some clowny sound effects. But we had, so, do you know Angela Dimayuga?
Yeah, we're good friends.
She was on our first day, and it was obviously incredibly exciting. Mm-hmm. But, and I've noticed this on a number of the guests where even though she's a chef, let's say, or you're an artist, the things that she's doing and the things you're doing are not at all what you'd expect, are not, again, on that linear definition of what a chef or an artist does. Mm-hmm. And what is amazingly, I think, really fascinating is like, and especially again, thinking back for a kid, high school, even early college, who wants to have the freedom to express themselves, to do what they want to do. Like, how the fuck do you figure out? Hold on, sound effect break.
Okay, sorry. How do you figure out?
Like, how is it? How do you figure out an ability? And I don't mean from like a talent point of view, from an actual living day to day, paying rent, surviving point of view, to be able to carve out a life that is so not typical, that there isn't a model of like, oh, that's how I do art. That's how what an artist looks like, and that's what I'm supposed to do to make a living. But so many guests are so fluid with the things they're able to accomplish and tackle and the projects that they can do and have success in them, mm-hmm. right? The fact that you're starting a spa, the fact that you're making a TV show. Again, I can't imagine there are things that you're like, I'm going to be an artist, and those are the things I'm going to do as an artist.
Yeah.
Is it strategic? Is it opportunistic?
I think it's just organic. Mm-hmm. Like, these are just things that I'm interested in doing. I think actually that was a really good lesson that I learned from Joseph Holtzman. He kind of was always, because Nest Magazine was a platform to think about art, but it was kind of thought through kind of interiors. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of amazing working with him, because he just really was, he always kind of reiterated that making art is never about like the actual form or like the medium, you know, and he was always just exploring these ideas through anything around him. And that was kind of really great, because before I met him, I was always like stuck in this kind of contemporary art loop, mm-hmm. and I was bored with it, I think. And yeah, so I don't know. These are just all things that I think are things I'm personally invested mm-hmm. in developing for the world. And I think they're more kind of complex containers for my skills and ideas I have around what art can be.
Do you worry at all anytime you're starting something or have an idea for something that you haven't done before, like starting a spa? Mm-hmm. I mean, the first question is always, do you ever worry that it's not going to work? Like, are you scared that it's like, oh, shit, this actually may not...
I feel like I'm so delusional that it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter.
It's key. It's important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was actually thinking about that recently, because I'm so delusional in every way, like, even when it comes down to time and schedules. Like, mm-hmm. I always... Like, I feel like I barely made my flight back, because I'm always like, oh, I could do all of these things today before I get to the airport. And it was like an insane day. But I think that's kind of how I work. And it's annoying for my boyfriend probably most of the time. But I think I'm getting a little bit better at being slightly realistic about scheduling, mm. at least.
But maybe also in defense of being erratic and just driven by passion. Mm-hmm. You also need, I think if you overthink your projects and you think through every single detail, how it's going to, you know, if how it's going to, if you have a business plan laid out and all these kind of things. I mean, obviously, if that's your only occupation, then yeah, you should have a business plan. But you know, I think it's also good to have projects that where those things don't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, that I mean, and again, going back to how Pinup started, you know, when it did, there was no business plan. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, there was enough money to produce that first issue, and then it was just
right
an open.
No, I love that it wasn't, you know, even meant as a business.
No, it wasn't meant as a business at all.
It was something you almost loved and needed to do for your own health, your mental health.
Exactly.
So I think, you know, if you, not everything you do has to make 100% sense.
Yeah.
you know, whether it's business wise or, you know, whether you think, oh, is there an audience for this? I think, you know, a lot of times if you feel very strong about something, you just do it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That ties into another thing that I keep hearing from people is that no, even
because just if I may add one more thing,
yeah.
Because if you, when you feel, because a lot of times people say, oh, well, I don't have the budget for this. If you, most of the time, when you feel passionate about something and people sense the urgency that you have of in creating this thing, then they're much more willing to also help out and, you know, in a way that doesn't immediately involve, you know, financial remuneration.
And, so I think that feeling of, I don't have the money to pay for this, nor do I even know how to do it, I think is actually a really good thing to note when you get those. Because if you knew how to do it, and let alone you had the money for it.
And at the same time, I'm not trying to advocate for, you know, oh, yeah, sorry, we don't have a budget. You know, that I think those are not words anybody really wants to hear. But I think when you do, it's a fine line, I guess. I don't know where to...
Well, I mean, I feel like sometimes I think about how there's money for art. Like, that's already crazy in itself, that, like, so much money gets spent on the production of art, even. And if you take a step back from that, you could even question, like, how you could have ever imagined, like, getting that much money to do something, like, make a thing for the wall or something, you know? But I also think that's something exciting about New York to me, that, like, when you have an idea, there are people interested in trying to make it happen as well, you know?
Did you find, when you were upstate, did you find, and now being in New York for, I guess, roughly the same amount of time, about 3 years, I guess, that being in the middle of the city versus being out of the city was better or worse or different for actually the creative side of thinking of things?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think at the time, before I moved to the city, I was at the time really into like decentralization in general. And so much of my life, I was moving and living in places that I thought were kind of on some, like, I don't want to make that hierarchy, but they would be thought of as kind of more peripheral places to be making work in. But I don't think of them as peripheries. I think that they're just as important. But, and so that was really important for me to not be in New York for a long time. And, but I think living upstate was a very specific situation. It was different than, say, Cape Town, where in Cape Town it was still a city and there was a lot of things going on and I felt engaged in the kind of conversation happening there. I think upstate was this first time I felt extremely kind of alienated and alone in what I was doing. I mean, I met, like, there were a couple people who were really important to me and collaborators there, but there wasn't a kind of bigger community.
But at the same time, upstate versus South Africa is so different because you're in upstate, you're still on the cultural periphery of New York City.
Exactly.
So you're just kind of like in this like tertiary space.
Exactly.
Whereas in South Africa, you're kind of catapulted into a whole different cultural environment.
Yeah.
I guess that's more of a question.
And I mean, upstate, it's funny because even though it's just 2 hours away, it was at times like extremely isolating, you know? And I think that was kind of the hardest part about it for me. Just like, and I think when I was like really idealistic about kind of decentralization, what I didn't really understand was how important it is to have kind of peers around you all the time who are invested in things that you're invested in. And I think that was the kind of biggest thing that happened for me moving to the city, where I just kind of, you're just exposed to so much and it's this constant kind of education that I wasn't, that actually doesn't happen in the same way as it does over the internet, you know? Like, you could be looking at stuff that's happening somewhere, but your relationship to it is completely different. Mm-hmm. So it was really important for me to actually move here.
Can I ask why you moved to Cape Town when you first moved there?
Actually, out of Berkeley, I was I kind of got funding to do research there. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that was kind of more oriented towards my research in urban studies. And I actually first went there to do a project about the South Africa World Cup. And I was really into like what they were calling like spectacle development and what it meant to kind of like present a space to the kind of international community through the media and kind of using these kind of big spectacle events. And I ended up going there and doing that project, and I ended up really liking it there and being interested in what was happening there. So I applied for more funding, and I ended up starting an art space there. And I was
Does it still exist, the art space?
No, it was kind of a very specific project, and it was like kind of catered towards like 10 artists that we selected, and it was like kind of creative development for them. And by the end of it, they were all like doing really well, and like they're like more successful than I am now, probably. And I was just like, okay, well, I can't help these people anymore. And so, yeah, I kind of, and I'm into projects like that that don't have to just extend their lives for no reason, you know, because it was a nonprofit, and I was like, I don't need to get into this cycle of raising money and blah, blah, blah. Like, if I can like work with 10 people and it can like impact their lives and their work in a way that was important, that's like, was enough for me.
So this is a broad question actually, for, I guess, for both of you guys. Because, and it's, I think it's coming from, at some point in your life, I guess, or in anybody's life, you sort of decide, whether consciously or not, to go a path that's made, and you're like, okay, that's what it means to be an architect, and I'm going to follow that career path, or that obviously what it means to be a lawyer, doctor, et cetera, like that. And you expect a certain amount of success, financially or otherwise, from that path. Or you make a break to say, I need to do something that hasn't been done before. There's certainly no guarantee of financial or comfort stability with that. But I guess the question was like, as when you guys were growing up, was there always a need to do something independently or on your own or in a way that you knew was not, was going to be different?
Well, it's really hard for me to work for other people or keep a job.
You knew that already when you were in high school.
Exactly. I always do this thing, like, well, when I was younger, every time I would get a job, I would always like try and convince my boyfriend about all the reasons why I needed to quit, like after the first week, and then after I would get their approval, I would quit.
What jobs did you have in high school?
Well, now I'm thinking about the first job that I ever had, and it was actually one summer when I was back in the U.S., and my parents were like, we're going to go to Texas for the summer, because I was born there. It was like outside of Dallas. It was like a Chinese suburb there, and I was like, I don't want to go to Dallas for summer, and they were like, you have to come. We're doing it as a family, whatever. And I went, and the first day we were there, I was like, can you just drop me off at the mall? I'm going to get a job. Like, if I have to be here, I need to make some money. And they dropped me off at the mall. Exactly. And I was like 15 or whatever the first legal age to get a job was. And I got a job in the food court at a Chinese restaurant called Manchu Wok.
So good.
I had to wear a shirt that said, orange, you hungry? And they, every single day of the summer, I was just there at the mall. And my family was so mad because they didn't get to see me. But, I mean, that job didn't, I wouldn't say it ended that well either. Like, they were about to fire me because, like, I was too generous with the portions. I was always like, oh, that person looks hungry.
It's a big person.
Yeah,
that person will eat a lot.
What was your first
job? Yeah, what was your first job?
My first job was working at the bar at the opera in Dusseldorf. Oh, but wow, I was actually
so classy.
Well,
that's why you play opera.
That's why I love opera. No, but they actually, I got let go as well because I was really bad at math.
Bad at math. Now you're much better at math.
Math, not meth. And the
it's a learning curve.
It was like only a 15-minute break or 10, 15-minute break. So they would basically storm the bar And you had to, within seconds, you know, had to.
Like, but you were actually working behind the bar.
I was behind the bar, and I was like
concessions.
Mixing concessions and like peanuts, and they were like, they also had like cheesecake and hot dogs, and I mean, it was like the works. And then they also had the these crazy prices, you know. There was like, oh, the, you know, Coca-Cola is two. It was probably Deutschmarks at the time. It was like 2 Deutschmarks and 70 cents. And then, you know, like the Prosecco was 3 Deutschmarks and 45 cents. And it had to like add it all up. It was really complicated. And I would just like say like, oh, just give me like, just give me 10. And so at the end of the day, the cash register was always off. It was always short, of course, never too much. So after a while, they were kind of like, oh.
We're too generous.
I remember I took 2 weeks off and they were like, you know what? When you're done with your vacation, you don't have to come back. And it didn't even register at first. And then after, as I was leaving, I was like, oh, I think I just got fired.
I mean, our problem is we're too generous.
Really. I was going
to
say.
Yeah. Actually, when I worked at this independent movie theater, I used to give everyone free tickets all the time. And I got in trouble for that, too.
And then I worked in a clothing store in Paris.
But I love that you guys were both doing retail and like customer service stuff. That's awesome. And like siding way too much with a customer.
Exactly.
I used to also babysit a lot. Even when I was like older, I was like I was like a popular babysitter.
I feel like you could probably offer a pinup babysitting service to the like design.
And I love babies.
Pinup playpen.
Yeah, to pinup kindergarten.
How about preschool? For dogs, for pets?
I didn't.
Have you ever been a dog?
No, I've never had any pets, so I don't know. I'm not sure.
I actually think you would kill it to do a design architecture focused like. Preschool, after school care thing.
That would be really fun.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Parents would love you.
Yeah. I think maybe Apartamento has already cornered the market on that.
Do they have a daycare?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but I didn't know they actually had one.
I think they had like a temporary one.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
wow.
And John, I have maybe a rounding out question for you in terms of, because you sounds like you grew up in a very Chinese community. Mm-hmm. Were there Chinese people or Asian people in general that were doing interesting stuff when you were growing up? It was like, oh, that woman, that man is actually kind of a rad person. And I, even if you didn't want to be them, but like you were inspired by them, was there much of a model then?
No, not really. I mean, I think in those terms, maybe the first thing I saw that kind of was inspiring to me was that film, Better Luck Tomorrow, which I think for most Asian
Americans.
Is that
Jet Li?
No. It was actually about these kind of high school kids in L.A. It was produced by MTV. I forget what the director's name of it, because he ended up going on to like do big blockbuster movies. But that film was like about these Asian American high school students who ended up like dealing drugs and then killing someone and burying them in the backyard. It was like based on a true story. And it was a good movie.
These guys look...
Oh, wow.
Let's see if I can find a soundtrack. So I'm just showing the screen grab from Better Luck Tomorrow.
But I feel like that was one of the few things that stood out to me when I was growing up, you know.
That there was like Asian people in popular media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, and even a film made by like a kind of Asian American person that I thought was good.
Who was the director?
I think his name is
Justin Lin. Yeah. He did a bunch of action stuff, I think.
Yeah. He went on to like just do blockbusters.
Yeah. Oh, he did Fast and Furious stuff.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Oh. Yeah. He cashed out.
Yeah. And Star Trek
good
Beyond.
For
good for him.
Exactly.
John, when is our turn?
I know.
You could be the next Justin Lin with your TV show.
I know. And then I could do a Transformers. but I think the other thing is, like, I'm working on this short film right now that's not finished, but I kind of started it last spring, and it was about Chinatown here. Mm-hmm. And it's something I'm probably going to show for a show early summer. Coming 2019 summer. And it's an all Asian cast.
Nice.
Except for one character. And it's all set like
in Chinatown.
Like five blocks of here.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I don't know. That project was really fun for me because it was very personal. It was like about the places I go. And I mean, so much of living in Chinatown and in this country is so confusing because like there's always film shoots in Chinatown, but I've like never seen an interesting depiction of Chinatown. You know, it's always like for some weird reason where they're like running through Chinatown and they like grab like some weird eel or something, you know? And it's like, and I was like, well, I want to make a short film about Chinatown from my perspective with my friends in it and my community in it. And it's also, I actually just finished grad school, and in my thesis, I made this kind of for my thesis, and I wrote about it, and I said it was about gentrification also, and people really criticized me for that. But in the background, one of the kind of characters is One Manhattan Square, that big luxury condo building that's going up at the end of my street.
Okay. Oh, and yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's gross.
Yeah, it's really crazy, and it's going to change the whole neighborhood.
Glass.
Yeah. Also, I heard there's, like, some issues with how they built it, kind of illegally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you heard about that.
There's something about it that doesn't look...
Well, it seems way out of place, like, just by the height of it.
Yeah.
And my understanding, I mean, I've actually never bothered reading because I just want to villainize it, but that the air rates they got to build it that high were kind of suspect, and they just built it. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what happens at that point. Are you obviously not forced to take it down anymore, but do you pay fine? I have no idea what the consequences are of
exactly
like what happens if you just build way too high. I have no idea.
Well, in my thesis, I was actually I was right because the film, I call it an erotic thriller, and to me it was kind of inspired by my favorite erotic thriller called Sliver, which have you seen that? Sliver. And do you know what the term sliver is from?
No.
It's actually informal architectural slang for these buildings that were going up in the 80s in New York. And they were like, it was about their like slenderness ratio. They were like really tall, skinny, like kind of luxury condo buildings. And that whole film is set in this sliver.
That's amazing.
And
that's what it is.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there was even in 2007, I think there was like a New York Times article talking about like the comeback, and they were saying something. It was called like Tall and Thin, Back in Fashion or something.
I feel like there should be like a Sliver remake right now.
Exactly.
It's a perfect time for it.
So that's what I was kind of working on, and I was like thinking.
Yeah.
Asian Sharon Stone. But so, yeah.
So that's finished.
It's not completely finished.
Okay.
But I shot it already.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you, because you live down the street from here, have you, so our office is relatively new. We've only been here a couple of years. Well, one question is like, did you move into Chinatown because you're Chinese?
Yes. I mean, actually, because I was living upstate for so long and it was like so white up there, like the first thing I wanted to do was just be around Asian people. Mm-hmm. And that's why exactly I just like moved straight here. And I love it here. It's like, I don't even want to live anywhere else. I don't even go to Brooklyn.
It's an amazing place. Yeah. Who goes to Brooklyn? And then second question is, did you get a chance, I mean, whether through the film or otherwise, to meet any like local Chinatown kids?
Yeah.
So I'm very curious what,
I mean, like. There's like different kind of characters in my film, but there is a kid in it actually. I was like casting from like my life, but I go to that gym, Manny Cantor, the community center.
We both go to that.
Yeah,
really?
We
Where
both
is that?
Go there.
We're gym buddies.
Where
it's
is it?
Right on East Broadway.
Okay.
He's clearly a little bit more dedicated than I am.
I'll go hang out outside the gym.
No, it's really cute, but they have like a preschool kindergarten thing, and there's like these really cute kids that are always going in and out, and I casted one of them. And she's going to be a star,
that's
I'm
amazing.
Sure. But I is also like basing characters off of like people that I just see around Chinatown. So.
Because I know that Bella went into, so we're across from the public library, and she started talking to some of the kids that were there after school, and they seemed completely freaked out. So what she was saying anyway, that they seem completely freaked out by anybody even talking about anything different or weird or new. I mean, we're not even that weird, this radio station, but it's not something that I think they were used to or expect. And I was just very curious if there was a general insularness with the families and the kids in Chinatown.
Well, actually, do you know anybody who grew up
in a couple
Chinatown in New York?
Yeah, one in particular that I'm thinking of is third generation, big. I mean, over time, his family built up a lot of the ownership of a lot of the real estate in Chinatown.
And so his really name, Jonathan.
And they still live in Chinatown.
You know Jonathan?
No, but I know about him.
Yeah, he's sort of like, he's like his almost like godfather in some way. I mean, he's young, but of the area. And his take on it is always really interesting in terms of what do we do with Chinatown?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of, my understanding is it's, there's a lot of second, third generation kids now that are, you know, getting late 20s, early 30s, starting to potentially take over whatever their family was running or their restaurants, like the Nam Wah guy, for example. Mm-hmm. And like, what do you do with it? Do you just repeat and keep the kind of, you know, Chinatown tourist version of what it is and grow it? Or do you do something different as long as it's Chinese? Like what's, do you just sell and move out? I have no idea, but
totally.
It's a really amazing, I mean, same thing. I find it, the more we get into it, the more amazing this area becomes.
Yeah.
And so I was like, if I want to stay down here as much as I can.
Well, I'm kind of curious to hear from Felix, because you've probably been in this neighborhood the longest, mm-hmm. right?
I've been in on East Broadway, yes, since 2006. Mm. I actually live, both our office and my house, my home, is on East, near, well, the office is on Canal and my home is on East Broadway. And when I moved to the area in 2006, I think it was, it's that weird triangle on where the park is. Mm-hmm.
And near Seward Park.
Seward Park, yeah, yeah, sorry.
Is that? Oh, yeah.
You know, Seward Park, where, actually, Mission Chinese. It's right mm-hmm. right next to Mission Chinese. And it's kind of a weird nexus, because you have Chinatown, but you also have what is, I think, called the Seward, Seward Park.
That's the kind of like...
apartment.
Northeast of the park area?
Yeah, the northeast, which is mostly, I would say, kind of... most people who live there are older, because mm-hmm. they all moved there in the 60s, I think, when it was built.
Your building?
No.
Or no, no, the other area.
All the, yeah, the yeah. kind of, yeah. And I would say predominantly Jewish. Mm-hmm. But then you have Chinatown to the east, and then south, it's where you have Madison and Rutgers, mm-hmm. is predominant, I would say, Puerto Rican,
okay.
Dominican. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, kind of where my house is where all those three. Mm-hmm. And then you also have, like, you know, just the wave of gentrification, which right. I guess I'm obviously part of, you know, coming in from the north, from.
The Lower East Side and stuff.
The Lower East Side, yeah. So, because in 2006, south of Delancey was not right. yet very developed. So,
I remember I had a friend that around, probably right exactly around 2006, 2007, moved right around the corner from where you live on Essex below, I guess, Canal or below mm-hmm, East Broadway, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. half a block. And, well before I think Mission Chinese was there and stuff like that. And I remember visiting and I was like, where the hell do you live? Where are
oh,
we?
Oh, I know. No, I moved there, even cab drivers didn't know what East Broadway was. They would think I would want to get off on the east side of Broadway.
Yeah. Which is so nuts.
The eastern corner of, yeah. So, the neighborhood has gone through radical changes. But at the same time, what you guys were also just talking about is, what's fascinating is that there seems to be a really tight, I don't even know if it's a tight-knit community, but like a kind of very resistant core of mm-hmm. of Chinatown, resistant to kind of outside change. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's hard for me to judge, because I also don't know anybody who grew up here or who, you know, kind of is a native, mm-hmm. if you were to use that term, for Chinatown.
But I mean, that seems absolutely totally true. I mean, both from hearing from Jonathan and other people and like reading about it, I think that's part of the problem now, is that the same generation of people that have been holding on and resisting change are frankly going to die off soon. And so that's where this younger generation is trying to figure out, do we just continue trying to resist in that same fashion?
Yeah.
Or what, you know?
Well, I think actually I've met more people of Chinatown through that organization, Art Against Displacement, mm-hmm. which that would be an interesting show for you guys mm-hmm. to do. But yeah, through that, I have like met like artists who are like third generation Chinatown and stuff like that, that I think are really interesting and are now kind of like speaking out more. I mean, they have been, but it's kind of, at least I didn't have as much access to those kind of voices until like I started becoming involved with Art Against Displacement.
Can you talk a little bit more about what they do?
Well, I'm not the best representative because I haven't been here for, like, I've been out of town so much, but they have a lot of meetings, and their kind of thing is fight, like, I wouldn't even say it's like directly, I mean, it is fighting gentrification, but it's also just making people really aware of what's going on in Chinatown in terms of development and politics. And it's kind of bringing accountability to like the gentrifiers, like maybe in the art community, like all these people starting galleries, and I don't know, like people who work at Dimes come to the meetings and stuff. And I think it's really great. I mean, it gets criticized, but I think there's a mailing list, and it's always like, for example, when the thing was happening with the hunger strike at one of the buildings, there was a hunger strike because one of the landlords was illegally kind of evicting and pushing residents out. And AAD kind of got involved in that and kind of spread the word and trying to kind of like gather resources and helping the people who were going through that. But in general, there's a mailing list that it's always kind of reporting things that are going on. And it's really, I think it's great.
Does it look to arts as a kind of activist?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's mostly speaking to the art community and trying to mobilize people to care and do something about it, because I think the art community has so much responsibility in the gentrification of Chinatown.
But I was, and this is more speculation than anything, but the impression I get is that there is a difference in the way gentrification is experienced in Chinatown in New York, because unlike in most other neighborhoods that are the fall victim to that undergo the process of gentrification, is that the people who are leaving actually are homeowners.
In the other places, or you mean?
No, in Chinatown. Mm. So the people are leaving, but they still own the property, and they rent to new people. Which is a very different concept than,
just like selling and like be gone.
Selling or being evicted, you don't own.
Right.
You know, there's communities where homeownership is relatively uncommon. Mm-hmm. And I think in Chinatown, it is something that, I think it's more common.
Right.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot of that is, again, from what I understand, that because these properties, these buildings have been within Chinese families again for a couple of generations, and for the most part, it doesn't really leave the Chinese community, right? You may sell or you may rent, but you're actually renting to another Chinese community. And all these developers or real estate owners were not really developers. They were just holders of property. And the concern was now there is so much pressure from almost every single neighborhood around Chinatown to build a hotel, to build a fancy condo, whatever, that eventually someone's going to sell their property because the value is so insanely high. I mean, I feel like the piece of land that Chinatown is probably the worth of it in terms of that market must be insane because it's so central, it's so close to everything. But that, can you still retain the ownership within the Chinese community and still...
Or do they even want to?
Yeah, well, I think that was part of it. Was like a lot of people just don't sell and move out or
move to New Jersey.
Yeah, and then does that hollow out?
Should we
out?
Do that?
Yeah. Anyway, I do think it's as a neighborhood probably one of the most fascinating neighborhoods because of all those pressures, let alone the actual kind of ethnicity of it and the culture of it, but. I also have no idea how to answer that problem.
Yeah. You should have Margaret on the show.
Yeah.
She'd be good at talking about it.
That's true, huh? Anyway, Thanks, guys. Thank you. Did you have an exit song? Otherwise, I was going to play the trailer.
Play the
for
trailer.
Better Luck Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That sounds great. Better Luck Tomorrow.
All right, let me pull it up real quick.
I hope you have better luck tomorrow with your guests.
Exactly.